You're listening to Context is King, news and views from the front lines of digital media. This week, why we chose Context is King as the series name, and Vice Media lands a new CEO. But first, the story behind our new Context.tv brand. Here are your hosts, Eric Cohen and Ashkan Karbisfrushan.
So we're back after a two-week hiatus.
Correct.
We started in New York, and we did some pretty cool stuff there. You want to talk about our New York trip?
Yeah, so basically we were in New York to conduct a handful of interviews with New York-based entrepreneurs, founders, builders, and we interviewed three people.
Namely?
Anthony Scaramucci, Rich Antoniello of Complex, and Rafat Ali of Skift, formerly Paid Content. And, you know, you might think those are three very different individuals, but...
But there is a common thread, right?
Yeah, I would say for some time now I've wanted to start a series talking to builders, not necessarily only entrepreneurs or CEOs, but basically people who, you know, have a concept and then turn it into reality. And you're going to say, okay, I get Rich from Complex and Rafat from Skift, but then you got to remember that Anthony Scaramucci...
The Mooch,
before his insane 11 days as White House Director of Communications, he actually not only, you know, after leaving Harvard, went to Goldman, got fired, got hired again, but then he left Goldman Sachs to launch two very successful hedge funds. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because when he was in the news, I actually kind of researched him a little bit to go like, well, who's this guy? You know, I'd kind of heard about him over the years. He also launched a conference called SALT. But on LinkedIn, his profile says entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So when I had this idea for this series called The Good, The Bad, The Ugly, I reached out to him and we exchanged some thoughts and, you know, he was gracious enough to sit with us. And you'll be seeing those pretty soon and we'll be featuring them. I think what we might do is feature like the unedited, long, complete sequence more as a podcast type.
Yeah.
And then publish like a 30, 40 minute more tight, condensed, version.
Can I say what the comparable is? Is it, we talked about it's a little bit like comedians in cars getting coffee, but for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, it is. And what's funny is when I asked Rich to come on from Complex, I had seen obviously Hot Ones, but I had not seen the blueprint.
And this is very much like the blueprint.
And when I said it to him, he's like, yeah, you know, he's like, exactly, you would think, eh? It's like, but I still do the interview because I like you. So I felt the one with Rich was probably hopefully the most emblematic, symbolic of what the series is going to look like, where we don't just talk about the latest trends in CPMs, market share, and Facebook. It's a lot about just like the harsh realities of being an entrepreneur, the struggles, the balance. It's a lot of balance between life and work.
And my favorite moment actually is when you were asking him about spoiling his kids or not spoiling, you know, family life. It's interesting to peek behind the curtain at what drives these people, not just in a business sense. You know, the Mooch interview was fascinating to me. Because we get a sense of the Mooch, his persona. And he is very much like his persona, but there was a lot more to the
case. Yeah, look, I think the Mooch one, you guys, I mean, the feedback was amazing. The people in the room really seemed to like it. The interviews themselves really liked it. Rich emailed me, was like, this was amazing, I had a great time. And yeah, I mean, I think with the Mooch, I personally would have wanted to talk a little bit less about the politics, but I mean, he was on fire, and the conversation went towards that. Look, and I mean, if you take a step back, I've spent 20 years since graduating college with a degree in business, swerving into media. I've spent 20 years in digital media, and it's been a blast. And, you know, yesterday I turned 40.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And, yeah, I mean, I kind of said, look, if I'm going to be running WatchMojo, I think that WatchMojo still has so much opportunity and that kind of brand that is all about fans and, you know, what you're nostalgic about, whether it's the Transformers or what you're passionate about, whether it's Game of Thrones, we cover that and we super serve our audience with top 10 lists and verses. And with talks, we get to go deeper and have a conversation about the crazy moments in Game of Thrones or, you know, why Canada failed to win gold in hockey or whatever you want to talk about. But for myself, you know, as a 40-year-old, I'm never going to be the kind of guy who's going to go sit on a beach. And one of the things we started to do, you know, I didn't call out and say, let's do this. Kind of by nature, once we started talks, we said, hey, why don't you come on and talk about VidCon and Viacom, which we felt like our audience may care about, and it kind of kept going and going.
Into something.
And then from there, Context is King, which is the first show on this kind of more businessy, you know, business life, I call it, portion of talks. Then, The Good, The Bad, The Ugly is like another show. And then, you know, that's kind of like, I would say, the continued evolution of Watch Mojo, the company, where, you know, we will probably be dabbling in this kind of new brand called Context.tv mm-hmm. to kind of just, you know, you got to keep your feet moving as an entrepreneur. As a brand, you don't want to go stale or you die.
Now, one thing that Rich said in the interview that I thought was really interesting is that he mentioned the fact that when watching these, you don't pull any punches. And, you know, you mentioned the Viacom, VidCon discussion. We've talked about Facebook. We've talked about BuzzFeed. We've talked about Vice. And you're not really afraid to call out, you know, companies on what they're doing.
Okay, fair enough. And I think you're right. There's two sides to it. I had a meeting in New York when we were there, and one gentleman I met, it's funny, when we sat down to talk business, he actually said, I won't name him, and I think I could share this because it's a general thing. He's like, wait, can I just ask you? He's like, are we here to talk business? And I said, yeah, what else are we here to talk about? He's like, well, you're a reporter, aren't you? And I was like, okay, I don't usually get called a reporter. I do get called worse things. I said, no, I go, I have been a columnist where I've covered the industry. I go, but that's a fair question. I go, unless I'm coming to you. I go, the default when I approach you is we're talking business, assume it's confidential. I go, if I ever approach you to do a story, whether it's for our own publication or as back in the day, Media Pulse or TechCrunch, I will say I'm approaching you first and foremost in a media capacity to cover this. But if ever in a private conversation you say something funny or witty, I'll just ask you, I go, can I use that? And you could say yes, no, on the record or off the record. Mm. But yeah, so it's not so much I don't pull any punches or not, it's that I don't feel like the audience gets as much value if I don't share, you know, kind of my wartime experiences in the trenches. So I do keep a lot confidential, right? I know in a follow-up segment, we're going to talk about Vice, which may or may not have a new CEO. I'm going to share some stuff that I feel is not confidential, doesn't violate anybody's trust, but that is interesting to the viewership. I'm not suicidal, but to Rich's point, look, I don't have an outside board. I'm not looking to sell the business tomorrow. I don't necessarily feel like I'm doing anything that's crazy. I'm just kind of sharing the experiences that I've had. And frankly, the feedback from the audience and, you know, whether it's people in New York, people who've been writing, I spoke in Miami last week, the people were like extremely like reacting well to it. So I kind of feed off the energy of what people like. If people say, yeah, we don't like this, I'll kind of take that into consideration. And it's not that shocking because Watch Mojo itself is a user-driven community, right? People suggest ideas, we consider them, and then we decide to do them or not.
But, you know, so you mentioned Miami. You just came back from Miami. You celebrated your 40th birthday. And you also posted something on LinkedIn yesterday that was about, you know, what a difference 5 years makes.
Yeah, so 5 years ago, we were coming back from Miami as well. Growing up, for some reason, I always had this, like, misguided, naive thing of, like, I want to retire at 35, which makes no sense because today I realize I probably don't want to retire ever. But so I decided, you know, I was in no position to retire. The company had finally broken even in 2011 or 2012. We were doing well. The Watch Mojo kind of brand that kind of covered top 10s had started to take off. And realistically, you know, I felt like I feel the spark. This is going to go somewhere. But at that moment, we probably had, you know, a couple hundred thousand subscribers. And we had been courted by a company in Dallas called Belo that wanted to acquire Watch Mojo. And initially, I was like, what do they see in us? But they kind of needed to place some bets in digital. And as much as I felt in my gut as an entrepreneur that we should not sell, that it was premature, I felt like, you know what, it's been 6-7 years, these guys are going to come, it won't be FU money, but it's a good sum to get, it gives stability to the team, and I really, really didn't want to sell, but I felt it was like the right safe thing to do. And then lo and behold, 5 years ago when I was getting into the airport,
From Miami,
the gentleman that was leading the talks, a fine lad named Tyler Martin, he called me and he said, okay, we're going to be moving ahead with the term sheet. You know, it was like bittersweet because I was like, great, can't wait for it. And then a month later, on April 1st, they said, you know, they sent in the term sheet. And then a couple months later, they said, we can't do the deal because we're selling ourselves to Gannett.
Which was another company that had been interested in.
We had just talked to Gannett. It was more partnership before. But the irony of all ironies is I was just so relieved. So yesterday at the airport, I was like, wow, you know, like sometimes in our conversation with Rich, I said, what's the one deal you didn't make that you're relieved because some of the best deals are the ones you don't make? And even though I love Tyler and I thought Belo was a fine company, thank God we didn't make that deal because just think of the epic run we've had over the past 5 years.
Yeah, 20 million subscribers up from a couple of 100,000 5 years ago, right? Not a bad place to be.
No, but I think the key is not so much to say, oh my God, we figured it out. It's really you gotta keep evolving, otherwise you die.
Context remains king.
And now, why we chose Context is King as the series name.
Context is King. You know, we've never discussed the title. Why Context is King?
Sure. So Context is King is a play off Content is King. Now, right. Some people attribute it to a 1996 article penned by Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, but that's not actually true. Content is King goes back to Viacom founder Sumner Redstone. And the idea was, as these new distribution platforms and pipes appear, now at the time he was talking about cable, then the value of your content grows because there are these new distribution outlets for your content. So if you fast forward to the internet, the idea was, well, now you have the internet and all of this content that exists now has new shelf to live on. Now,
is it possible to even go back further to Marshall McLuhan with The Media is the Message? I mean, was that the precursor to all this?
Exactly. I mean, Sumner Redstone described something that was happening. Now, the reason why I liked Context is King and I registered the URL was I used it eventually as like the title of my fourth book, which I kind of have a vague idea
which
of the
topic. Which
you're
writing right now.
Which I'm writing right now as we're speaking with my feet. No. but the idea for me, context, is really the marriage between content and distribution. Mm-hmm. And that means context. A video about Led Zeppelin on a Led Zeppelin fan page takes one meaning. But a video of Led Zeppelin about a biography, and I'm just thinking randomly stream of consciousness, on a page on plagiarism, totally different context.
Right.
So context to me is the marriage of content and distribution. And I used to say if content is king, online distribution companies have a lot of power, some would argue even more, then, you know, context is the prince, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what makes it all, you know, it's like the actual relative value, so to speak. So we went with Context is King because, you know, there's so much when a traditional reporter writes about something, I feel there's a little bit of context missing. And here, as like a media insider, an industry participant, I felt like we were taking things that you read about and just added a little bit of context in them.
And context.tv. This is going to be the...
Yeah, I mean, so I was actually kicking around names. I felt like, look, WatchMojo, what are the content verticals that are most associated with WatchMojo today? Yeah, back in the day, we did fashion, business, travel. But realistically today, it's gaming, movies, TV, anime, music. It's largely entertainment with like a factual slant. So it's kind of infotainment. I feel like if you're going to launch a gaming channel, like Mojo Plays, you want to build off that Mojo brand and give it something that's related, but that's a bit different. But if we were going to launch like a travel brand, you could go with Escape Mojo, but it might make sense to go with something totally different. With business, I viewed it the same way. And it's not really business. We're not here to, you know, give you stock quotes. We're not here to be, you know, Business Insider. We're not here to be Bloomberg. There's a specific area in business where I feel like I've basically for 20 years served the young pro audience. First by writing columns for young professionals. Even WatchMojo, our core demo, sure, it goes from 12 to 45, but it's basically 18 to 34. So here, I think it's more about, you know, what are the things one needs to be aware to succeed in life? And my first book, Course to Success, served that audience. And I think with context.tv, because I like that idea of context as king and I want to bring it all together, that's kind of like, it was just a name that resonated. And, you know, it's really more of a side project. I think, like we alluded in the previous video episode, is you got to keep your feet moving. You know, at 40, I love entertainment as much as always, but I'm very passionate about these other verticals. But I don't feel the company will be well served if I walked in and said, hey, man, we're going to take WatchMojo, where people come for top 10 videos on movies, and force people to watch this travel destination video. It's not really true to the audience's desires.
Let's talk about Miss Mojo.
Sure.
Because, you know, there's Mojo Talks, there's Mojo Plays, Mojo Espanol or Mojo Francais, those at least are still...
Well, yeah, because the idea with Espanol, Francais, Deutsch, and all that was you were basically taking at the core what we were doing on WatchMojo and translating them. And there could have been an argument that we should have, like, brands that were more unique to that market. But the flip side was there's so much clutter that I felt, well, you want to draft off your strength, right? Mm-hmm. Now, with Junior Mojo, it was a very different ultimate end user, kids. Mm-hmm. But it was going to leverage the educators and the core audience that now has kids or has nephews and nieces for them to say, hey, I like Watch Mojo. Little Jimmy, why don't you sit down and you can watch these videos because I trust the source it's coming from. Miss Mojo, you know, to be frank, the name Miss Mojo was coined by a female employee at Watch Mojo. And to me, it just made sense. Now, on day one, we had a lot of pushback. People were like, why are you gendering? Why are you, segmenting and all that?
Especially, I was like, these days.
These days. Where it's like, you have a student in, I forgot where, that got banned from school because he said there's two genders. And then it was like kicked out of school, which is like the other extreme of, nonsense. But anyway, the point I want to make is, and the nonsense part being that you can't speak up, not right. Whatever position that person was holding. Notice how I have to clarify what I say as well, too. But the point is, with Miss Mojo, I didn't want to mislead the audience. I felt like, look, the same way that Hearst has Elle or Mademoiselle, we want to be honest and say, look, we can't do stereotypical, perhaps, but we can't do top 10 One Direction songs. Mm-hmm. On Watch Mojo without the message section, the comment section turning into mayhem. And like, I got a 9 and 7-year-old daughter. If they grow up to like, Megadeth and snowboarding and things traditionally associated with male, all good. Doesn't make any difference, but realistically.
You want to give them the option.
No, but realistically, if you go to an Avril Lavigne or Taylor Swift concert, you're going to see more ladies in the audience. And I think we've gotten to a point where we're not honest about that aspect and that reality. So for us, we just said, look, the channel is going to gear predominantly to a female demo because historically, certain segments of the audience, of the population have different interests. So with Miss Mojo, after the initial outrage, which was just the vocal minority, Miss Mojo makes sense in that 80% of the viewership is female, whereas 80% of the Watch Mojo viewership is male. So it kind of made sense to go with that. But those are all still iterative of the core brand because their programming is all similar. With this, I just felt it was an evolution of the company evolving. So you maybe wonder what's this problem.
Right, exactly.
So like in Miami, I was reading this book of the secret history of Lazare Frères and Company. So the Lazare brothers were basically three Jewish brothers who in the 19th century started a company, basically a bank for just to dumb it down, their mergers and acquisitions advisory. And it's kind of like we talk about evolving and the problems we face. And when Miss Mojo launch, we had a lot of noise, like people saying, oh my God, this is, why did you choose it? You're gendering, you're segregating.
I was like, look, we're giving
the people what they want. And today you look at the community, it's flourishing and people love it. But it's also important, you asked me when I came back and you're like, how are you doing? I said, are you glad to be back here? And I said, I'm glad to be wherever I am. I think it's important to be positive. So, these guys, I was talking about this in Miami. I go, three Jewish brothers in the 19th century in Europe. Could you imagine the prejudice and discrimination they faced? Then they continued to build their company through changes in technology and evolution and all that. And then like they went through two world wars, of which the second war, some of the family was in Europe, some of the family was in the US. There's family fleeing France as the Nazis are invading and taking over the country, still trying to build up and run their business as they flee to the US. So as I'm reading this, I just laugh because I go, we've grown to 60 people. And like if on a given day I come in and people are like outraged over Miss Mojo, I hear them and I understand them, but I kind of smile and go, you know what? I'll take these problems over problems that other people have had to endure in their lives at whatever times they've had.
Like the Louis C.K. line about being on a flight and I can't have the pizza.
Could you quote Louis C.K. anymore? Is that? But yeah, that's true. I go like, you're getting on a plane. It's like yesterday we were delayed for 3 hours at Fort Lauderdale. And I'm like, who cares? I just want to land. I don't care when I land. Anyway, we're going on a bit of a
truth.
Yeah, we're going on a bit of a sidebar, which is all good. It's the purpose of this show. But yeah, I think the idea is we want to expand, and when we feel we are reinforcing and super serving our audience, the brand will be Mojo related. But if we feel like, look, there's a subset that is gonna love this programming, then at that point, it might make sense to venture off in another brand, and hence Context.
Context is king.
And now, Vice Media lands a new CEO.
So Vice, by the time this publishes, Vice Media may very well have a new CEO. What are we thinking?
I'm not really surprised. I think Shane Smith really deserves an award and should be in the Hall of Fame of like content for making content sexy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, almost Shane single-handedly made private equity guys and big media companies come out and pay such a premium to ride the Vice train.
Do you think, let me just ask right off the bat, do you think that when they started their punk zine way back in the day, that they had the savvy? Like,
no,
is it something
at all.
They accrued?
No, no. I mean, look, first of all, to go back, I didn't finish the answer because I think in this era, he had to go, unfortunately. But we can come to that. Yeah. So just to jump to your question. No, I don't think they had the savvy, and I don't think they would admit that they had their savvy. I've met Shane only a couple times in person, but we've emailed and chatted quite a bit, like dozens of times over the years. If you read also their stuff, they admit that they weren't necessarily like business savvy, but I think Shane is the consummate sales guy. Shane, by his own admission, forget selling ice to an Eskimo, he could sell shit to the poop master of all time. Like, he's just, that's what he does, you know? And he gets up there and he'll say stuff that may not even be true, but people just are like, okay. It's like, and in a boom market, when they see revenues growing and other people lining up to sign checks and get on the cap table, other people then kind of want to get ahead of the line. But I think a lot of it was kind of parlaying that anti-establishment shtick to billions of dollars in valuations despite the fact that they were bringing all these corporations on board.
Right.
So you knew that eventually something was going to give. Now, a lot of people felt that, okay, as you bring on investors, despite thinking that you may be in charge of the board and whatnot, you ultimately serve that master and not anybody else. That was a plausible outcome. Other people felt, okay, if they actually go do an IPO, he won't want to be the CEO of an IPO, a publicly traded company. Other people thought that eventually just the lifestyle might get to him and he may be burnt out. But look, I think the Me Too and Time's Up movement is serious. You know, I've said that this is like the Emancipation Proclamation. I think this is kind of like the civil rights movements. This is a long overdue correction and day of reckoning. And as much as Shane was early on saying, look, I'm no Harvey Weinstein or whomever, I've been very vocal and public about our roots and origins. If you are privately held with no corporate or institutional investors on your cap table, you could have kind of gone outside of the shadow and maybe survived. But in this era, I just felt like, and then combined with the fact that they missed revenue targets by $100 million, despite having their best year ever, despite the fact that it's a two-way street, context is king, is sure they've grown their value to $5.7 billion, which is awesome, but that means there's less and less exit options for them. So I think when you kind of bring all the factors together, Shane was a figurehead that the Me Too movement was like, yo, this can't stay. And I feel like the bigger thing is he probably, when this all started, had people on his board that were like, I'm your biggest fan, Shane. Don't have to worry. Let's just ride it out. Whenever somebody says, I'm your biggest fan, they've probably already slept in your bed, so to speak. Mm. You know? So I think that was just something that was going to happen. And if you think about it, the New York Times expose came out around Christmas, like Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And I feel like for the past 2-3 months, he's probably been behind the scenes trying to... this is all guess, right? I mean, this is just... You know, I think he probably has been trying to salvage his spot as CEO. If I were him, I would have done it differently.
Well, so who... Let's talk about the person that is most rumored to be taking over that spot.
Well, I don't think it's a rumor. I think it's A&E CEO Nancy Dubuc, who is basically, you know, A&E gave them the channel that became Viceland.
Right.
The ratings aren't doing too well. Of all the corporates, I don't think... The only person that I thought might be made sense to come in as interim would be Tom Freston. But he's like 70-ish, and he probably doesn't want to be day-to-day, and he's like, why the hell would I walk into that situation?
And imagine him advice.
Yeah, imagine him advice. But the thing is, he deserves a lot of credit for getting Vice to what it is. You know, he kind of knew media like the back of his head. But I don't think it would have looked well if you replaced Shane Smith with an old white dude either. To be honest, I mean, that's just...
So instead, Nancy Dubuc, is it... Is it significant? You know, you mentioned Me Too and Time's Up. In this era, is it significant that Vice Media would appoint a woman as CEO of what was formerly known as pretty much a boys' club?
Does Snoop Dogg like weed? Yes. I mean, it's a no-brainer. Now, to be fair, those who come out and say she only got the job because she's a female, that's stupid because she has a Midas touch, or is seen. Nobody has actually a Midas touch. It's a perception. The perception, and based on her track record, is she has like the Midas touch of programming in terms of like show picking. She's the one that greenlit Dynasty Duck. She's been
Duck
on
Dynasty.
She's the one who, like, before any of this happened, Vanity Fair picked as like top 100 movers and shakers of the new establishment. You know, she has a tremendously, it's funny because last night I looked up her LinkedIn profile, which is totally underestimates what she's done. It only shows A&E CEO. Mm-hmm. But when you actually go and research what she's done, she has a prolific career. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it was more because of the Viceland needs to remedy that, so to speak. And she knows that intimately well. And A&E wants to protect its investment. And I think if you're Disney, Fox, or any of the other companies, you don't necessarily want to parachute your own guy because it's such a thorny situation. So this presents itself as an envious, elegant solution. But again, if I was Shane, I would have played it very differently.
How would you have done it?
Well, I mean, if you want to go total Godfather mode, I like to say if you're not part of the solution, you are the problem. Mm-hmm. I think if I'm Shane, once I start hearing in Q... And Shane, by the way, was always very... I mean, you could criticize Shane for a lot. Shane, in my career, gave me some very good advice. And if there was any way that I would have... If you would have cared to listen to my two cents, I would have, you know, offered it, despite the fact that, you know, a Vice right now is a bit of a thorny brand. But if I'm Vice, I would... When I hear that this New York Times expose is coming out, I would basically go out there and start to look for my replacement. And I would basically say, I got to...
Handpick your own.
Not necessarily handpick my own, but if you really even want to salvage your own neck and come back, I mean, you could go gangster and even get that person to kind of agree to eventually have a timeline, which is what Travis at Uber wanted to do. He wanted to go get somebody and then kind of after a few years, leave the door open for him to come back. I think maybe that's the story with Nancy, but by clinging on to the CEO role more and more, you become kind of more and more toxic. Not talking Shane, in general. Mm-hmm. Like if people come on board and for whatever reason, let's say I bring on investors and you know, if they say, Ash, we need to bring fresh blood, you could say no once or twice. But if you really, really start to cling on, then they just kind of get more and more aggressive, and then it becomes less about you and your role. It's just about, you know, I'm saying A, you're saying B, I'm going to really fight for A. So here, I think if Shane would have gone ahead of that and bowed out in fall and then brought somebody on, then he would have probably had a better chance to make a return. I don't even think he really cares to make a return if he leaves. He probably pocketed hundreds of millions of dollars of the $900 million that they've raised. Good for him, you know, it's his right. He, on paper, is worth billions of dollars. I think he'll probably want to ride into the sunset, just take a break from this, and then come back doing something different. And he'll always still be like the... He'll probably remain, I'm guessing, chairman of Vice. And even if he's not the chairman, just through ownership, you know, he'll remain like the head honcho there, so to speak. But I did always think that this was it was kind of inevitable.
You know, there's something else I want to bring into the discussion. We have about a minute. But National Geographic, Nat Geo yesterday released a statement that...
Well, again, that's a perfect thing. So Nat Geo comes out and says, we were going to go look at like racism in media or racism amongst cultures. And we said, hey, let's slow the train. Let's go take a look at ourselves. That's getting ahead of it. Mm-hmm. That's knowing that, hey, if you put this out there, people are going to be like, hey, Nat Geo, meet this mirror. You guys are freaking phonies. You always describe black people as they won't admit it this. You describe Africans as savages. You describe Aboriginal Australians as like, you know, idiots and all that. How dare you come and pinpoint to others? That's getting ahead of yourself. Now, I'm not saying that gives them like, hey, scot-free, you don't have to answer for how you've treated certain people in the past, but that's an example of getting ahead of yourself. And it just goes to show times have changed.
Yeah, and context is king.
This was Context is King for the week of March 15th, 2018. Your hosts were Eric Cohen and Ashkan Karbisfrushan. Follow them on Twitter at @EricCohen and at Ashkan, A-S-H-K-A-N. Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. For video versions of these discussions, go to youtube.com/mojotalks.